be here this afternoon, and Carol's going on tip, some of the work that we're doing in the area of equality at the Research Center. And so I'm going to start out and give you a little bit of background information about some of the variation, the sources of variation, and some of these things that we measure. And I'm going to focus mostly on meat tenderness, and that'll give you a little bit of background for understanding why we've done some of the things that we've done and what the rationale was. So we do focus on tenderness a little more than other equality traits, and there are a number of reasons for that. I'm not going to go into all of those, but part of it has to do with the fact that there's a lot of variation in that trait, and there's a lot of consumer satisfaction related to that trait, and so we spend a lot of time on that. Another reason might be a recent development, and that's that the USDA has recently instigated a certification program that describes the parameters around which you can market a product that might be USDA tender or USDA very tender. So that program is in place, and theoretically that will stimulate a little more interest in people paying more attention to tenderness, more variation in tenderness, and maybe doing more of the things that we know might lead to a more tender product and something that would be worthwhile as a branded product. So just a little bit of information about what are the sources of variation in tenderness, and how some of these things might impact tenderness, and how we might be able to manipulate that a little bit. So these are some of the things that directly impact tenderness. I'll go through a little bit more detail about these, but the marbling level, the contractile state, so I'm talking about how much shortening the muscle has gone through as it goes into rigor mortis. The amount of degradation that some of these proteins go through as you're aging the meat, and how that might relate to improving the tenderness. And then the amount of connective tissue that's in the muscle is related to tenderness. So this is just a chart to indicate that although there's a fair amount of data that shows that marbling really doesn't explain a high percentage of the variation in tenderness, certainly there is a positive relationship between increased levels of marbling and increased eating satisfaction. And this is just one example of some data showing that as you increase the level of marbling score, that you do increase the acceptability of consumer life ratings. So it is a positive relationship. It does not explain a huge amount of the variation in tenderness, but it certainly, if you have and compare a wide range in marbling to one another, then likely you'll see a difference in consumer satisfaction. So if we turn to connective tissue, and the primary protein in connective tissue is going to be collagen, then this is some data showing not variation among animals, but variation among muscles within an animal, and just illustrates that certainly the importance of connective tissue probably is more apparent in different muscles within the carcass as opposed to variation within a single muscle across animals. Certainly, if we're thinking about animals that we produce that are harvested at a fairly young age and really haven't gotten to that point in their life where a lot of collagen cross-linking is going on, that would make that a more important factor. So this just shows that as we look at different muscles, and you see at the bottom, so at the bottom here we have the tenderloin, and you can see that it has the lowest concentration of collagen. And as you go through the muscles, and it's increasing here up to some of the muscles in the chuck and the round that have higher levels. And certainly those are related to variation in tenderness among those different muscles. The next one I want to talk about is the contractile state, which is the amount of shortening that a muscle goes through as it goes into rigor mortis. Certainly this impacts level of tenderness. And again, I'll show you some of the variation that we see among different muscles within the carcass. For sarcomere length, which is our measurement of that amount of shortening, And again, you see there's a fair amount of variation among the muscles. Again, one of the extremes is the tenderloin muscle. Based on the way the carcass is found, the amount of tension that's applied to that muscle, it actually gets stretched beyond what it would be at resting length. And that also is contributing to its level of tenderness. And you can see we go through the lift down the top sirloin, and the ribeye are on the lower end of a greater amount of shortening that occurs in those muscles, and it would be tending to decrease the level of tenderness that you would see in those muscles. The next one is the proteolysis that occurs during aging, and that's primarily by the calpain proteolytic system. Mucalpain is the enzyme that gets enough calcium in the postmortem environment to be activated so that we get some breakdown of proteins. Calpastatin is the inhibitor protein that regulates the amount of calpain activity. And both of these have to see a certain level of calcium before they will become active. And our measurement of proteolysis generally is one of these proteins called desmin. It's one of the key structural proteins that helps hold the muscle fibers together. And if you degrade that protein, then the muscle will become softer, easier to chew, and have less integrity that would increase its tenderness. So we use that as an index of the level of overall level of postmortem proteolysis that has occurred in the muscle. And this is just a chart that shows shear force over here on the this axis to indicate the level of tenderness. So as we increase shear force, then we're decreasing tenderness. The time postmortem here to show that there's a fair amount of variation in tenderness. And this is primarily related to the fact that there's a lot of variation in the amount of proteolysis that occurs in these different muscles. And this is the ribeye muscle. So during the aging process, we may have some muscles that go through an extensive amount of proteolysis and end up increasing in tenderness dramatically. And in other cases, we have very little proteolysis, and the muscle will still be relatively tough, even with a significant amount of aging time. And this just looks at different muscles and how they might vary in the level of proteolysis. And ironically enough, if you look down here at the bottom again, one of the extremes, we see the tenderloin has very little proteolysis, and yet it's still very tender. And I'll talk more about that in a second. At the top, the most proteolysis in the ribeye here, and the bottom round. Again, some of these, if you look at them independently of one another, might give you a false or an interesting perception of what the tenderness of that muscle might be just based on any one of these different traits. So what turns out to be the biggest issue, the most important thing, is the relative amount of all three of these factors in any given muscle towards understanding how tender it might be. So just to give you an example, if we look at longissimus, which is the ribeye, and the infraspinatus, which is the flat iron, these two muscles have about the same level of tenderness, although certainly there's animal variation, but in this example, they're about the same level of tenderness on a trained sensing panel scale of 1 to 8, with 8 being most tender. And if we look at the relative contributions of these three traits in these two muscles, we see that on sarcomere length, or the amount of shortening, the infraspinatus is very long, but the longissimus is fairly short. If we look at collagen, we see that the longissimus has less collagen than the infraspinatus, and so a bigger contribution to tenderness there. And then proteolysis, longissimus is much more degraded than the infraspinatus would be. And so even though if you look at any one of these traits, you might get an erroneous impression of what its tenderness might be, when you combine all those together, you actually end up with the same level of tenderness. So each of these can have a big impact on tenderness, and it's really important to know the contribution of all of them combined before you can understand what the level of tenderness might be in any given muscle. So I couldn't stand up here and talk to you without saying something about breeds, and you probably are mostly familiar with the GPE project and the results that have come out of that. So I'm just showing a summary here that might indicate more and less tender average values for different breeds that we've evaluated. And you can see we have a group that are more tender, slightly more tender, a big group really that's average, and a few that are slightly less tender and a few that are less tender. And primarily, probably the biggest thing that we've learned about breed effects on meat candidates is that every breed has a huge amount of variation. In every breed, we can see very tender and very tough. Obviously, the difference is the relative amount, the relative number of those. And certainly, we've learned a lot about the contribution of Los Indicas to the tenderness, and the calprostatin levels probably play a role in that. There's some other interesting things about breed differences, the myostatin gene and Piedmontese. So there are some breed differences, but certainly we can't eliminate all the variation in tenderness by selecting a breed that on average is more tender than another one would be on average. There's also been a lot of work done on genetic markers for tenderness. I just want to discuss one study, maybe a couple of studies. We've gone out, and there's always a lot of discussion about populations that you develop this information from and whether or not that's relevant when we go out and try to apply that in practice. There's, I think, going to be more and more opportunities for this. This is just one study that we wanted to ask the question is how applicable is some of these markers, and this just happens to be the mucalpain marker 4751. How useful would it be in just a random population from commercial carcasses? And so this just shows that if you look at the animals that are homozygous tender, have a homozygous tender form of that marker or a homozygous tough, we do shift the distribution of slash shear force to 14 days postmortem. So the tough ones are out here and the tender ones are back here. And you can see the red bars are the homozygous tough that that distribution is shifting fairly significantly. So you can see an impact of those markers even out in populations that have absolutely nothing to do with the population of those markers are developed on. We've also done a study looking at implants on tenderness and combined that with the tenderness markers. And so this, in this case, this is the mucalpain 316 marker. And we were looking at a study to compare mild versus aggressive implants and then look to see, number one, how much difference in slash shear force did that create and whether or not we could use selection for these markers to offset any of that difference. And what we found out was that the aggressive implant did end up with a decrease in tenderness or an increase in slash shear force. And if we selected animals that had were homozygous for the more tender allele, then we could get that tenderness level down to the same or even slightly better than those animals that were on the mild implant treatment without the favorable tenderness allele. So there is a potential for some impact there. We've also done a fair amount of work with the beta agonists, and we'll look at a couple of those. This is a study looking at the interaction of levels of crude protein in the diet and the level or inclusion or not of ractopamine or the Optiflex product. And I just point out there was no effect of higher or lower levels of protein in the diet, but we did see a significant increase in slash shear force with the addition of Optiflex in the diet. And when we look at the frequency of samples that we might consider to be significantly tough, they were not different. And when we look at our prediction of our instrument prediction of tenderness, there was no difference there during the treatment. So a small decrease in tenderness, but in this case it was significant. This is a study looking at Zilmac, and this is the work that we did last summer. What we see is that if you look at the slide shear force of 14 days post-mortem, there was a significant increase in slide shear force. Likewise, if you look at the percentage of sample that has greater than 25 kilograms of flagship force, which we should consider tough, that also was significantly increased, as well as our tentative prediction instrument percentage that it would predict to be tender was significantly reduced with the max treatment. So I think there have been some varied results related to Gilmax treatment that have come out, and we're doing some additional work that I'll talk about in a moment. This is the data showing a subsample of that previous experiment where we took strip loins from that from those carcasses, and then had these different aging times. So we looked at 7 all the way through 42 days of postmortem aging, and to see what was the impact of that on the slideshare force. And we see that, as we indicated initially, there's a big difference in slideshare force. Those lines are starting to come together, but even at 42 days, they still are not the same. And the regression shows that it takes 35 days of aging in the Optiflex, the Zilmax fed cattle, to reach the same level of tenderness in the control that 14 days postmortem. So these are things that we have going on relative to beta agonists. It seems clear from our data that the Optiflex, although it does also have a slightly negative impact on tenderness, the magnitude is not nearly as great as what we see in the Zilmax. We have done an aging time study like we did with the Zilmax last year, so we're going to be doing that this summer. The second thing that we're going to be doing is with Zilmax heat stress mobility study in collaboration with the University of Nebraska and with some funding support from the Nebraska Beef Council. And that's clearly to look at some of the issues that have been brought up about that product and its impact on animals. And so we're going to be collecting a lot of data. Those animals actually went on Zilmax treatment this morning. So the first half of those animals are divided into two weight groups. So the first half went on trial this morning. So we'll have that data later this summer. And then the last thing that we're going to do is take that group that I just talked about and take a subsample of those strip loins and do some consumer work. There's been a fair amount of work published that says, yes, there's a difference in tenderness, but if you age it long enough and then feed it to consumers, then they can't detect the difference. And not to say anything about anybody else's work, but when we see the magnitude of the difference in shear force that we've seen in our data, it's hard to imagine that consumers couldn't pick this up on that. And so I guess to satisfy ourselves more than anything, we're going to do a consumer study of our own and see if we can detect any technical differences that we would see. If you come out to the center on the tour tomorrow morning, then we're going to look at those panels that are on trial. So we'll be able to do that. The next thing I want to talk about is dark cutting. And dark cutting, I'm not sure whether to describe it as a big problem or not in the beef industry, but the last beef quality audit had it about 3.5% incidence. Certainly, sometimes of the year, it's much higher. Certainly in the fall, we see higher levels of that. And it can have a big impact on some of the population and some of the meat. So we were interested in looking at this question a little closer. And what we did was we went to plants and selected carcasses that had varying levels of dark cutter in the ribeye, so severe, moderate, mild, and shady. These have differences in pH because the higher the ultimate pH of that muscle, the darker the lean looks. And then we also selected, every time we selected a dark cutter carcass, we also selected a normal color, clean colored cohort from that same lot of cattle. And so we ended up with an internal control, essentially, for each of those that would account for lot differences and so forth. And what we found out was that there are some impacts on tenderness of dark cutting. If you look at the moderate and the severe, well, the severe dark cutters are the most tender of the group. And If you look at the ones that are called shady, which are just slightly dark, but generally not dark enough for the graders or the company to discount those, they actually are the toughest of the group. So there's some interesting things going here, on here related to animal stress and final pH of that muscle and how it impacts the calpain system and how aging progresses. So the slightly dark ones were the toughest. The most dark ones were the most tender. And the intermediates and the normals, the controls were kind of intermediate. So trying to understand what caused some of these differences. We looked at sarcomere length and Desmond degradation, and we really didn't see a lot to explain that. So we're not sure where that leads us. The other question that we needed to address with this study was what was the impact on flavor. And certainly there was previous information indicating that some levels of dark setting have detrimental effects on flavor. And that's exactly what we saw in this study, where if it was a severe or moderate dark cutter, then we saw significantly higher levels of the flavor note rancid and the flavor note musky, which would generally be considered off flavors in a beef product. So the conclusion from this is that certainly there are some impacts from dark cutting on the meat quality. The direction and magnitude of that depends upon the severity of the dark cutting. If they're only slightly dark, they're more likely to be tough. And if they're severe or moderate, they're more likely to have all flavors. And probably the most important impact of this is it might be these slightly dark ones that, as I mentioned, they aren't dark enough to get discounted. They end up in the normal product mix, and so you'll find these in the U.S. Select and U.S. Choice product lines, where the really severe dark cutters generally get discounted down to standard, and you wouldn't see those in the normal product mix. Another area that I want to talk about is some work that we just finished recently, looking at what we might be able to do to improve tenderness, and this is what we call freeze age. Generally, people would have the opinion that freezing and thawing meat is a bad thing to do, and it decreases its quality. But it just so happens that there's some interesting things that go on in the muscle that I want to share with you. So the question is, can we take advantage of what we know about calpain and calprostatin to come up with a way to maybe improve tenderness? And the issue is that when you freeze meat samples, and it takes a bit of time, but after four or five weeks, you actually lose most of the activity of calprostatin. So theoretically, that might mean that if you freeze the meat to store it for that long and then thaw it out, that with calprostatin gone, you might actually get more activity from calpain. And so the idea would be to freeze meat, store it that long, thaw it out, and then age it, if calpain has an opportunity to be active and more active at that time, then age the product and see if you could actually get more tender than you would if you kept it fresh and aged it for that period of time. So this is the data that says, and let's, so this is both the ribeye and the eye round muscle, and we have the slide shear force and the percentage of those with slide shear force greater than 25 that we would consider tough. And so let's just look at the red rows here. So this is fresh. That was measured at 2 days post-mortem, and this was frozen at 2 days post-mortem and then thawed the next day. So just freezing and thawing effect by itself without any additional aging. And you see slide shear force actually is improved just by freezing and thawing. And that's not a new finding. There's data out there that says that depending on the conditions you freeze and thaw the meat on and how large the ice crystals are formed in the muscle, if you freeze and thaw slowly, or at least if you freeze slowly and get big, large ice crystal formation in that tissue, they will actually disrupt it a fair amount and improve the tenderness of the meat. So freezing and thawing alone can improve the tenderness of the meat. And you see that in both muscles and in the percent considered to be tough. And if you do the same thing at 14 days post-mortem, so age it some first and then go through freeze and thaw, or freeze the thaw here and just fresh in today's 14 days. You see also a small improvement that is significant, but because you had some aging on the front end, it's not as big of an effect. So now let's look at the effect of freezing at day two and thawing immediately, or freezing at day two. And both of these were stored for 5 weeks, okay? Stored 5 weeks in frozen storage and then thawed. But this one was thawed and then sheared immediately. This one was thawed, or was aged another 12 days after the freeze. So this is a freeze-thaw treatment. This is just a freeze treatment. So we have a total of 14 days of aging in this group. And you see there's a significant improvement in tenderness, the reduction in shear force, and percentage of cuff in both of these muscles. If you compare that to the fresh aged 14 days, which is the same amount of total aging time, you can see that it's significantly more tender as well. And again, you see it's essentially the same effect, even if you had some some aging in front of those freezing processes. So aged 14 days and then gone through that process, still a significant increase in tenderness in both muscles, and more tender than just aging for that total amount of time. So I think that this is a process that has some potential. The biggest issue with this process is that the same structural damage that you create from freezing and thawing that might increase tenderness is also going to cause a lot of moisture loss in that product. And so unless we can fine-tune that process of freezing and thawing so we can minimize moisture loss, this process probably isn't going anywhere. But there are a lot of companies that have some pretty modern freezing capabilities these days and that are interested in looking at this question. So we're going to try to see if we can fine-tune that process enough to take advantage of the tenderizing effect and without creating the other issues that would prevent them from being able to take advantage of it. So I want to talk just a little bit about predicting tenderness. We've developed a system that's based on visible and near-infrared reflectance. It's we've collected a lot of data on this system. We have there's more than this now, but the last time I made this slide, over 4,000 observations. And just to show that this technology is not accurate enough to measure individual carcasses and use that as a method of valuing the carcass. But on a population, it definitely is good enough that you can move the mean of a population and increase or decrease the percentage of tough samples that you might have. So this just shows the distribution of slash shear force. The white bars are those that the system did not predict to be tender. The dark bars are the ones that the system predicted to be tender. And you can see that distribution is shifted to the left. In the predicted tender, we have only 4.9% that would be considered tough, with 21% in the not tender group. So it definitely, and this is after a lot of development work, and basically this is the validation that we did over a period of years in a lot of different plants. So it has some potential. We followed this up with some work to see what was the impact of making this measurement on the ribeye, what impact did that have on all the other muscles. And so we had about 20 other muscles. I'm just going to show you one, and that's the top sirloin. But making the measurement on the ribeye at the time of normal grading would allow you to segregate other muscles, and in this case, the top sirloin, as well, based on their tenderness. So the tenderness of the gluteus medius from a carcass that had a more tender ribeye, then that gluteus medius was more tender. And there was a significant effect like this on 5 or 6 of the major muscles that was related to making the measurement on the ribeye. So this is data to show, I'm not going to talk about that. It's too complicated. So this actually is a picture of that system that's been commercialized. And has essentially not garnered the implementation that we thought it might. Goldman Ryan, Tender Age, Beats is actually the only company that ever implemented this for making the judgments and segregating the product, but they were using this system to funnel product into that branded label. And I think because of that, the company that was producing it and manufacturing and selling it decided to quit supporting that technology. So we've been looking for alternative producers or marketers of that kind of a technology. In the meantime, we decided that maybe the yield and quality grading instrument that we developed that virtually all of the major beef plants have operating in their plants now, beef companies, maybe there was an opportunity to get enough information from that system that we might be able to predict tenderness. And so while we were trying to find someone to support the NIR system, we started collecting data with this system, and it turns out that we could predict tenderness a bit almost as well as we could with the NIR system. So we just completed the last data collection for that and working on developing the model for doing the prediction. The preliminary models, when we were about halfway through, were good enough that the USDA AMS did approve the system for Nolan Ryan to start using that in his program in place of the other system that it wasn't supported, and was afraid that the next time the system broke down, then they were going to be out of luck and not able to sell products. So they have been able to switch to that system. So
what's it called?
This is just... it's manufactured by E plus B. It's called the BBG 2000 beef carcass grading system. So Nolan Ryan is using that, and I will stop there and see if you have any questions.